Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be joining me for the second and third segment of today's program. We did record that show last evening, and it was great to hear James again. He had a great vacation, and he has a lot of insight into we discussed Iran and some many, many other things. So please make sure you stay tuned for James Corbett for the second and third segment of today's program. But let's get started right away for the first 20 minutes. I got a story for you, and it is Thursday, May 10th, 2018. And let's take a peek at gold today. Gold was up 840 with all the goings on in the Middle East and some rockets going and words being said. And but I don't think that is that's probably pretty mild to what I think we might see in the future. But anyway, we had an $8 move in gold to the upside at $1,321. Silver managed to be up 24 cents today at $16.80. Platinum was up $12 at $930. And palladium was up 24 at $1,005. Crude oil today was down 48 cents. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar index was down 48 cents at 92.62, and crude oil today was up 30 cents at 71.44. And the markets too just shrugged off and brushed off all of the geopolitical tensions that are happening around the world. And we got the Dow, particularly in the Middle East, we got the Dow up almost 200 points, 196, 24,739. You have the NASDAQ up 65 points at 7,404. You have the S&P up 25 at 2,723. The two-year yield is holding at 2.97%. Euro was stronger today by 0.69 at 119. European and Asian markets moved only slightly. There's absolutely no fear in the markets. In fact, it bumped up almost 10 points. The fear and greed index, you know, between the emotion of fear, neutral, you know, being in between the two, and greed, we're at 54. So it's almost a little over a halfway point. So it truly is amazing. It just goes to show you, no one's paying attention to anything. And they're just going along their happy old way. And, you know, I wish that was the case. I wish we were at the time I could tell everyone, hey, sell your gold. It's time to sell your gold. But it's not that time. And it's time to be buying. It's time to be to acquire your gold and silver. It's time to accumulate. And because of the story I'm going to tell you, it's just one example of what so many people, particularly people that are nearing retirement age, are going to be facing. I think one of the important things I saw today, I don't know how important it is, it'll be important to people's pocketbooks. You hear Butch talk about it, about gasoline prices, how they are on the rise with these geopolitical tensions in the Middle East, and we've had the plunging Venezuelan productions with their problems, and also from the withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Yesterday, we saw oil prices surge to its highest level in more than 3 years, and we have Goldman Sachs. They're estimating $82.50 a barrel, which really isn't that much of a stretch considering where we're at today. However, with those with what could happen in the Middle East, it certainly could get there very quickly. They're looking to by summer to be that $82.50 by summer. Goldman Sachs said that yesterday. The U.S. is going to target Iran's crude oil sales. Sanctions that were lifted under the deal will be reimposed following the 180-day wind-down period, as the U.S. Treasury said yesterday. And the reason I bring that little bit in there is it's being reported that there's gasoline prices are topping $4 out in California. Everything is more expensive in California, but again, it's showing the trend, higher gasoline prices, and it certainly could put a little damper on the economy. A year ago, the national average was $2.34 for a gallon of gas. And now today, that average, national average is $2.81. So you get a little turmoil, a little geopolitical tensions, and certainly these gasoline prices can jump very quickly. I'm going to get started right away about this story, and I'm going to give credit to, there's no name to the who wrote this, but the Sovereign Man. And it's a great little story, and I want to share it with you. There is a moral to the story at the end. And again, it's a story about a manufacturer. And it also tells us that it really doesn't matter how many regulations will be eliminated, how many tax reforms there are, unless there is some sort of miracle or a default on debt, which is going to happen anyway, there's only one outcome. To those who are depending on their pensions, unless you insure it with gold, physical gold. So when you have this amount of debt that cannot be handled, that cannot be managed, there's only one way out of it, and that's to default on it. What can't be paid won't be paid, as we've heard so many years. So on with the story. It's about a candy company. It was in 1923. It was a Jewish immigrant from a small town in modern-day Ukraine, founded a candy company in Brooklyn. And he called it Just Born. His name was Samuel Bernstein. And if you enjoy chocolate sprinkles, you know, or the hard chocolate coating around the ice cream bars, oh, that's who invented them. Bernstein, he invented them. And I know as a little girl, I loved, I don't like all the little colored ones. You know, you can find little white ones and pink ones and green ones and blue ones. I always liked the chocolate sprinkles. And so now I know who made them, who invented them. So nearly 100 years later, the company is still a family-owned business. They produce some well-known brands like Peeps, Hot Tamales. I know you know those names. But the business conditions in the land of free have changed quite dramatically since Mr. Bernstein founded the company in 1923. The costs to manufacture in the United States are substantial, and business regulations can be outright debilitating. And one of the major challenges that's facing Just Born, the candy manufacturer these days, is an underfunded pension fund. Like a lot of large businesses, Just Born contributes to a pension fund that pays retirement benefits to its employees. Sounds like a great little plan, doesn't it? And in 2015, Just Born's pension fund was deemed to be in critical status, prompting management to negotiate a solution with the employee union. The union simply demanded that Just Born plug the funding gap, as if the company could merely write a check and make the problem go away. The only one that can do that is government, and they only make the problem go away for a little bit of time, because eventually, it's the old kicking the can down the road. But management did push back, and they did try to explain that the pension gap could bankrupt the company. As an alternative, the company did some things. They proposed to keep all existing retirees and current employees in the old pension plan. We heard other companies do this while putting all new employees into a different retirement plan, thinking they'd be able to save some money that way, and maybe they'd be able to extend the pension plan a little bit longer, and maybe there'd be some miracle that they would be able to fund the complete retirement plan. Seemed like a reasonable solution that would maintain all the benefits that had been promised to the existing employees while still fixing the company's long-term financial problem. Promises. That's all we ever get anymore. Promises, promises, promises. And when you have mismanagement, those promises can't be kept. But anyway, back to the story. The union refused their solution, and it was a reasonable solution, and the case went to court. So 2 weeks ago, the judge ruled, and the union won. Just Born, the candy manufacturer, would have no choice but to maintain a pension plan that puts the company at serious risk. So it didn't matter that the company was trying to do something to come up with a solution to keep the plan so they could stay in business. Nope, the judge ruled, union won, and it literally is the textbook insanity. The court and the union want both to continue the same pension plan, the same terms, but they're expecting different results. It's as if they think the entire situation is going to somehow magically fix itself. Those of us living on planet Earth, well, we can figure it out what's coming next. In a few years, the fund will be completely insolvent. And this company, it employs hundreds upon hundreds of well-paid factory workers in the United States, will probably have to start manufacturing overseas in order to save costs. Honestly, it's some kind of miracle that Just Born is still producing in the United States. The owners, they could have relocated overseas years ago. They could have took those tens of millions of dollars in labor and tax savings, but they didn't. And you'd think that the union would have acknowledged that and tried to work away with the company to benefit everyone in the long term. But thanks to their idiotic union, these workers are stuck with an insolvent fund and zero job security. Now, here's the weird part of this story. Just Born, the candy manufacturer, contributes to something that's called a multi-employer pension fund. So it's just not their pension fund. They don't own it. They don't manage it. And they're just one of several large companies. And it's typically, you know, within the candy industry who contribute to it. So this raises an important question. Who manages the pension fund? Ding, 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 ding. Yes, of course, the union. It's the union who manages the pension fund. The multi-employer pension fund that Just Born contributes to is called the Bakery and Confectionery Union and Industry International Pension Fund. This is a union pension fund. It was founded by the union, and the president of the union even serves as chairman of the fund. So basically, the union mismanaged its own pension fund and then legally forced the company into an unsustainable financial position that could cost all the employees their jobs. Just Born, of course, is just one of the countless other businesses that faces a looming pension shortfall. You've heard all about General Electric. They have a pension fund that's underfunded by, what, $31 billion? Bloomberg reported last summer that the biggest corporations in the United States collectively have a $382 billion pension shortfall. But don't worry, the government to the rescue. They long ago set up an agency called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation that is to bail out insolvent pension funds. It's sort of like the FDIC for pension funds. The problem is the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, and you heard me talk about this, the PBGC on this program many times, it itself is insolvent, and that needs a bailout. According to the PBGCs, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation owns financial statements, their own financial statement, they have a net financial position of minus $75 billion, and they lost $1.3 billion last year alone. And the federal government, they're really not in a position to help. According to the Treasury Department's financial statement, Social Security and Medicare have a combined shortfall exceeding $40 trillion. Public pension funds across the 50 states have an estimated combined shortfall of $1.4 trillion, and that's according to a 2016 report by the Pew Charitable Trust. So does it really take a rocket scientist to see what's coming? Solvent, well-funded pensions and state national retirement programs are as rare as mythical unicorns. They don't exist. Few do. And how long can they continue? Nearly all of them have terminal problems and will likely become insolvent if they're not already. The unions are driving their own pensions into the ground, and the government has zero bandwidth to bail anyone out, least of all itself. So if you're still more than two decades out from retirement, you can't forget about any of these programs. You can forget about any of these programs being there for you as advertised. The government can't fix this. The union won't or can't fix this. There's only one person that can fix the problem, and that's you. You have to fix your own retirement account. And when we talk about, you know where I'm going, ladies and gentlemen, gold and silver. When these debts are defaulted, adjusted, it's not going to be by 10% and 20%. It's going to be huge. It's going to be 70%. There's reports 80% that you'll see these adjustments. If you're lucky, at least you get to keep 30 and 20% of your money. Some people that might lose it all. And, you know, we talk about debt. We see these prices go rise and rise, and we hold on to the hopes that maybe we can change things around. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not going to happen. The government can't fix this. It's too big. We're talking trillions and trillions of dollars, just not here, but globally. The world is synchronized. They have synchronized their debt to keep this illusion going, and they'll keep it going for until the cows come home, until they can continue, until it will collapse on its own, because they don't have any other choices. Why collapse it today when they can make a few billion extra dollars in the next year if they can keep it going for another year? So I love that story. It's about a candy manufacturer who's been here for so long, and now they're going to have to face and make decisions. Can we make our candy someplace else? I think we saw that with Hershey. They moved their chocolate factory to Mexico. I really don't like to, you know, nothing against Mexico, ladies and gentlemen, but Hershey, just, I was raised around Hershey, and it really isn't quite the same. But 1-800-375-4188. I hope you enjoyed this story as much as I enjoyed sharing it with you. But there's a meaning, there's a moral behind this story. And we're in this debt problem, and we're bombarded with distractions day in and day out, 24/7. But yet no one is talking about the debt. No one is talking about your money. No one is talking about how to protect you when it comes down to the point of when these systems collapse. We will. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. We're heading into a break. James Corbett will be joining me, and we'll be back in just a few short minutes.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom. And for the next two segments, I am pleased to welcome back from his well-deserved family vacation, the always informative James Corbett. Good evening, James, or good afternoon.
Good morning, technically. It's 11:22 a.m. as we record this.
We're going to get them all. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. And I want to let the listeners know that you've been away for a little bit, and we missed having you, and it's great to have you back. And you are the founder and the editor of the Corbett Report, and the listeners can view everything that all of your viewpoints, your worldly viewpoints. They can visit the Corbett Report. TheCorbettReport.com. That is correct, right? I got that right, James?
Either CorbettReport.com or TheCorbettReport.com. Both will take you there. And, of course, I also write for TheInternationalForecaster.com. I write the weekend editorial for them.
That's right. How could I forget about the International Forecaster? All my listeners are going to be very upset with me. But I'm so thankful that you were able to carry that on for Bob Chapman, and a great job that you do. And it's a great little newsletter for the listeners to get copies of it and to share it and get subscriptions. But so welcome back. And did you learn anything about life while you were away?
Well, I got to introduce some of the members of my family to my daughter, who they haven't seen yet. She's just turned two, and so that was nice. But other than that, no, I tried to avoid work as much as possible. But being an inveterate workaholic, I did actually have several videos and things up my sleeve, so I was able to keep things going on the website while I was away. Because you gotta keep feeding the beast, and
yes,
gotta keep up with what's going on.
Yes, you do. Well, the big news, I mean, there's a lot of news, but certainly we've been talking about it quite often during the last couple of days on Financial Survival, about Trump's decision to abandon the Iranian deal. Being in Japan, and there's lots of things to talk about, various aspects, and there's one about the sanctions in Iran about precious metals, but we'll get to that a little bit later. Certainly oil is a big deal. But what do you think will be the impact that is felt, if you can sum it up, but felt around the world, the U.S., in Japan? Or is this just something that, is it not a big deal? I think it's a big deal, but...
Well, I concur. I think it is a big deal, and I think there are two things that I want to stress here. One is that there is, of course, a nuclear-armed nation in the Middle East that is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, has never been inspected by the IAEA, does not even officially declare its nuclear stockpile of somewhere between 100 and 400 nuclear warheads. No one knows how many because, again, it's never been officially acknowledged or inspected. And that nation is not Iran. It is Israel. And that's the big glaring elephant in the room in all of this. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed. So I'm going to be doing a podcast on that I hope to have out in the next 24 hours or so. People can stay tuned to CorbettReport.com for that issue. But the other part of this, I think the bigger ramifications of the scrapping of the deal in particular are to do, actually, I think, with Europe. Because the thing that perhaps is not being stressed enough right now is that this was not a deal between the U.S. and Iran. It was a deal between the P5 plus one and Iran. And the P5 plus one includes, of course, Germany and France and Britain and some of the other players in this international deal that was struck. So the fact that the U.S. president has not recertified the deal, as was part of the agreement every, I think it was 3 months, the U.S. government basically had to recertify the deal, certify that Iran was in compliance. Trump has obviously decided not to do that, despite the fact that there is truly no indication whatsoever that Iran has violated or abrogated the deal in any way whatsoever, but they're just not going to recertify. So one of the implications of that is that the North Korean nuclear negotiators, you would think, have to be watching what is happening right now as the U.S. literally tears up an existing nuclear agreement that they signed just 3 years ago in front of the world's face. You would think that might play into the negotiations on the Korean Peninsula. But also, I think the other part of this is it really does put Europe in a driver's seat right now. Whether Europe is, the European nations are going to step up into some sort of role and challenge the Americans on this, because European companies, at the very least, if nothing else, do stand to lose out from these sanctions that are going to be slotted back into place. And apparently American diplomats are going around warning German, I think German diplomats in particular, but European diplomats in general, warning, hey, you guys better watch out because your companies might get sanctioned if you're still doing business with Iran. So Europe really does have a decision to make in this one, whether they're going to just go along with Uncle Sam once again, or whether they might actually grow a backbone and put together, cobble together some sort of remnants of this deal, which theoretically could go forward as a P4+1 deal, just without the United States in it. And if that happens, I mean, we could be looking at a shift in international geopolitics as Europe aligns more towards the East and what is happening out East, in the Far East and the Middle East, and less towards Uncle Sam. Or we could just see the maintenance of the status quo and basically Europe kowtowing to whatever the U.S. demands. And I think that is going to be an extremely important pivot. I think this is a general geopolitical phenomenon that's taking place over a period of years, but this might be one of the key inflection points where we really see which way the European domino is going to fall.
Well, if the Europeans go at it on their own, would they have, quote-unquote, time? Because, I mean, it's viewed that the reason that the long-term reason that this accord, or whatever you want to call it, was dropped by President Trump is they want regime change. So who's going to win out first?
That's a very good point, because obviously diplomacy will take a backseat if and when military tensions come to the fore, and we're already seeing that with Israel claiming Iran strikes on the Golan Heights, and now there's going to be retaliation, or perhaps there is already retaliation going on for these strikes. So it could very well escalate into a military event very quickly, and more quickly than any sort of diplomatic machinery can come along to pick up the pieces. And so you are quite correct in that. And I think really this has to be seen as a pretense towards some sort of military ramp up. I mean, I don't think there's any other way, any other lens or filter through which to see this lack of recertification other than as the next level of the steps towards Tehran, basically. And that has been the goal of the neocons, obviously, for a very long time now. It's just a question of whether this will be the event that starts to kick it in motion, or perhaps whether the Israeli tail will wag the American dog once again and will actually start a military confrontation that they'll expect Uncle Sam to finish. And that, unfortunately, is looking like it might be coming to pass already.
And you know what? Yes, I saw the headlines, and the headlines were, and I'm thinking to myself, boy, this sure ramped up pretty quick, and how convenient, all of a sudden, and it's like we were just led down this path by Israel, and like, what interest does the United, how does it serve the United States, to where we could have perhaps change that agreement somehow to make it more acceptable,
Well, I think that's one of the big canards here, is that there's some sort of big hole in this agreement that needed to be patched up, and it's not going to work, so we have to scrap it. It's never been clearly articulated what that hole is exactly, considering this is one of the most restrictive nuclear agreements that has ever been placed on any nation. It is truly phenomenal the extent to which everything conceivable was built into this agreement to make sure that Iran would not be able to proceed with anything approaching a nuclear weapons program without it being signaled a very far way away by inspectors who are allowed unprecedented access in the country. It really was a pretty comprehensive agreement. And if there's some sort of concern that, oh, eventually there's a sunset and 2 decades from now they might be able to ramp up their program, that hardly seems like the kind of thing that needs the entire deal to be ripped up in the face of the international community. Again, I think this has to be seen as part of a larger game plan that has been prepared for quite some time with Netanyahu. And I think it was a McClatchy headline that I saw just in the last 24 hours that put it well. It was something to the effect of, with the scrapping of the Iran nuclear deal, American-Israeli relations are the best that has been in a decade.
Yeah.
As if that's the central point of all of this. Well, okay, well then I guess it's good. But you know how quickly things have seemed to have amped up since this, and I think that's, in a sense, that's just us coming to the attention of this issue, which has been boiling for, at the very least, weeks now. You'll remember that in the wake of that Syrian chemical attack or whatever did or did not take place, and I think it's highly questionable that any sort of chemical event did take place a month or so ago in Syria, but in the wake of that, while the U.S. was still deciding that it was what it was going to do, you remember Israel actually did do some strikes in in Syria on Iranian targets in Syria because they were basically upset that there were some Iranian forces that are in Syria now. So I think this tension has been there. I mean, even the military tension has already been there for several weeks, and this is just another excuse to amp it up again.
I don't know if this matters, the question I'm going to ask you, but the agreement initially signed in 2015, I mean, was it a bad deal to begin with? You says it was the most restrictive when it comes to any nuclear planning and for inquiries and so forth. Was it a bad deal to begin with, or were the people told? I mean, it didn't go through our Congress or anything like that. It was done on an executive order. But the fact that it was signed and agreed upon.
Well, I think, again, I think that the onus falls on the people who are willing to scrap and walk away from the deal to articulate precisely what was so bad about the deal in particular. And they'll point to things like the Iranian government getting billions of dollars, a lot of it in cash, as Trump pointed out during his speech. This was money that literally was the Iranian government's, that the U.S. was holding back from them as a result of all the sanctions and everything. So it's not like that this was money that was just rained down from heaven or something. This was money that actually was destined for Iran anyway, that was being prevented illegally if given the international agreements that were in place. All of the different talking points that have been raised, oh, it's a bad deal, have never been articulated. If people want to know in more depth about the deal itself, Gareth Porter, for example, has done a lot of reporting on this over the years. A lot of his stuff is carried by antiwar.com, but he reports for a number of different outlets. And Trita Parsi of the Iranian-American Coalition, something along those lines, has also written books about this deal and what it actually accomplished. And when you go into the real specifics of the enrichment process and what kind of enrichment is allowed and how these facilities are being inspected and the types of things that Iran gave up in pursuit of this deal, it really is phenomenal. And there has never been a nuclear agreement with any nation that has been as restrictive as this one. So again, I think the onus falls on the people who say this was a bad deal to actually articulate what that means and what kind of deal they are looking for that would supposedly replace this. But that should have been done well before the deal was not recertified, which again is the U.S. Technically, theoretically saying that they won't certify that the Iranian government is in compliance with the deal. But that's not even what they're saying. Iran is in compliance with the deal. They're just saying they don't like the deal. So everything about this has been dishonest, and really a whole bag of tricks has been pulled out here. At the end of the day, again, I think this is ultimately about Israel and Netanyahu, yes, and what they wanted, and Trump is just going along with it.
And it just amazes me that, you know, so many of the American people just don't even see it, and they, you know, it's, they just, Now, whether this is for, I mean, it's hard to believe that this would be used just for another distraction over something else, because this is a pretty big distraction. You know, you would think that they'd be a little more clever to come up with some other distraction that wouldn't have the impact that this is going to cause.
Stormy Daniels, if you will. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, we have, we're going to get close to a break here, so let's just finish this up on Iran. You have, supposedly all these sanctions will be, I've been told that a lot of these sanctions are still on, but there's many more that are coming. You're going to have Russia. I think Russia was even part of the deal, or China, Turkey. They're all going to have an impact. India, with the oil. Is that a separate deal? What is there a bigger impact to these countries? I mean, India, they import from Iran. China, they import from Iran. Will they be able to get their oil from other areas?
This is going to be a case of the same old thing all over again, because obviously these sanctions, and I believe it is the same sanctions as existed before the deal, are going to be slotted back into place, which will create a similar situation to what we saw, say, 5 years ago, where we had things like the oil for gold for oil exchanges happening between India and Iran, for example. There's a lot of ways to get around these types of sanctions. And in fact, a lot of the infrastructure, the financial architecture and infrastructure of the last several years has been developed specifically looking at the way that the U.S. was sanctioning Iran back in that period several years ago. So you have, for example, China and Russia having colluded to create an alternative to the SWIFT global banking network and things along those lines, again, specifically being done because they looked at the way Iran was being financially targeted during the sanctions period. So if that all goes back into place, again, it really just further incentivizes China and Russia and all of these other kind of peripheral players to this Iran deal are going to once again be motivated and incentivized to create ways around the American global monetary infrastructure. And that in a sense, it's America stabbing itself in the foot because, again, it's creating enemies, or at least all alternative systems that will ultimately bypass the U.S. and speed up the process that we already see going on right now of the U.S. dollar, the petrodollar, being eclipsed. And that's really just going to be helped along by these types of stabbing themselves in the eye kind of events.
Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, one of the sanctions that they were going to, I don't know, again, we don't know if it's one that's been already placed on or a new one, to where Iran would be unable to purchase gold and precious metals. And I thought that was an interesting one even to bring up in a conversation. But we're going to have to hold that thought in your answer until we come back from this break. Please stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Please visit our website at dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. I'm very pleased to spend these two segments with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Please make sure you visit the website. It's got a lot of wonderful information, and you're going to have a new podcast coming out about Iran. Would you like to just tell the listeners a little bit about that, James, please?
Yes. Well, specifically, this is going to be about using that presentation that Netanyahu made last week about the Iranian nuclear program and the incredible secrets that they discovered about them, which are 15-year-old, long-acknowledged and long-understood parts of the Iranian abandoned nuclear weapons program, basically using that as a launching point to start talking about the elephant in the room, which, of course, is the Israeli nuclear weapons stockpile, which, again, is officially not acknowledged, although everyone knows that it exists. The only question is how extensive, how massive it is. But we know that they have at least a couple hundred nuclear warheads trained on Tehran already. And that's an interesting part of this story because, of course, the whole narrative is that Iran is some out-of-control, crazy regime that's threatening the world, whereas it is, in fact, Israel that has the nuclear weapons and is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. In fact, one of the great ironies of all of this is that it was Iran, four decades ago now, that initially proposed a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, which was opposed by, you guessed it, the U.S. and Israel. And that idea has been refloated again and again, including even last decade, by Iran. And Israel continues to not want to do that for its own obvious reasons. It wants to maintain its nuclear stockpile and just make sure that nobody else in the region can have one. So it is, it's a giant glaring hypocrisy right in the center of all of this that I think it's still a large part of the public doesn't really know or understand that aspect of this story. And I think it's important to be bringing that out while we're talking about this issue.
Very good. Well, you know, you mentioned that everyone thinks this Iran is this big, dangerous, crazy country. Well, it wasn't that long ago where everyone also thought that the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un was a crazy person. And now we have President Trump that has done what everyone thought was impossible just a couple of months ago. There is a meeting that is scheduled, a summit, to happen in Singapore. I guess Trump announced today that the information would be released in 3 days. Who knows if it's 3 days, 2 days, but supposedly 3 days, that they would give a little more information as far as to the time and a little bit more details about that. And so, I mean, it is sort of fascinating to see, you know, the same views on this country. Now we're having this summit, and you mentioned a little earlier that how do you think he's going to approach this summit? He did release three prisoners, three Americans that were held captive. They're going to be flying into the East Coast, Andrews Air Force Base, and Trump will meet them there at 2 a.m. this morning. Similarities between the two countries, any at all? Or are they independent of each other? Or is it just part of the, can this agreement get done and will it have a lasting impact?
Well, there are some major things afoot on the Korean Peninsula, obviously, and potentially world historical. So, again, so much hangs in the balance of this the coming summit or whether it happens at all and what will be discussed. So it's hard to predict, especially about the future. So I think I'll refrain from making any bold proclamations about what will or won't happen. But certainly something is underway. And as I say, I think that the American abrogation of the Iranian nuclear deal is not a good portent for things. Surely North Korea, as I say, has to be looking at that. Anyone negotiating on that side would have to be looking at who they're negotiating with and taking into account the fact that any potential deal can apparently be torn up on a moment's notice for no reason whatsoever. So that, unfortunately, I think undermines the situation. But we have seen some incredible progress. I'm sure everyone's seen the startling pictures of Kim Jong-un and embracing Moon Jae-in and leading him across the border and all of this. Truly some amazing things that were inconceivable even several months ago are starting to happen. Let's see if we can get this to continue. I think one of the most amazing things that I've seen, one of the best, most brilliant diplomatic moves that I've seen in recent months, came on the part of Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, who, when asked about whether someone floated the idea of whether he would be nominated for Nobel Peace Prize for this, he said, "Oh, don't give it to me, give it to Trump," which I think is a brilliant thing to do because, of course, I think everyone knows that plays directly into the ego of the president and would probably be, if anything, would encourage him to get a deal done. It would be, "Hey, don't worry, you'll get the Nobel Peace Prize if this happens." So I don't know if it's just playing on personal psychology, but anything that actually assures peace on the Korean Peninsula would be, after 60 plus years of war, I think would be a welcome bit of event. So anyway, it's clearly things are happening and it would be extremely important. I think the most important part of this, the denuclearization and all of that, of course, is something that is greatly talked about and speculated on here in Japan and elsewhere in the region. But I think the most important issue here is if not the reunification, at least the normalizing of relations between North and South Korea, and maybe some allowing for movement of peoples across that border would be an incredible and really important event. I think ultimately whatever peace results is going to have to come from the Korean people themselves, not dictated to by the outside powers that have put their nose into the peninsula. So I think that's going to be the most interesting part of it from my perspective, to see what kind of relations develop between North and South Korea. And it's a minor thing, a very minor thing, but people might have heard that Kim Jong-un has scrapped the Pyongyang time zone that he instituted a few years ago, the half-hour difference between North and South Korea. Again, it's pretty symbolic at this point, but hopefully it's a sign that things are moving in the direction of détente.
Well, I was under the impression that when Moon became president of South Korea, that he wanted to repair the relationship with North Korea. And there is a pipeline that wants to be laid from Russia through North Korea down to South Korea. And to me, that's what this is all about. This is why these relationships are being handled in the manner in which they are. And from my understanding, I could be wrong, probably am, but shortly after Russia came out and made the statements about their military and some of the weapons that they have now have achieved, it was a week later or shortly thereafter to where all of a sudden these relationships and Kim Jong-un decided that he was willing to be a little more friendly, you know. So, you know, when Russia came out and said, "Hey, well, we're going to defend our friends so you can't mess with them," it's like everything just started to fall into place.
Right, and, yeah. Well, I wouldn't say that's why what is happening is happening, but it is a significant factor in what is happening. And to step aside from any sort of advocacy, obviously I'm interested in peace, but to step aside from advocacy and just look at the situation as it exists, we have to understand that there are incentives on both sides of this issue for some sort of deal to get done, and also for some sort of deal not to get done. And from the American negotiators' perspectives, that might be one of the factors in this. If you have peace on the Korean Peninsula and you see the construction, for example, of a pipeline like that from Russia down through North Korea to South Korea, what are you doing? You're creating an economic boon for all of these various players in the Asia Pacific that suddenly don't necessarily need Uncle Sam quite as much as they did before. Also, there are billions upon billions of dollars in contracts that have been awarded to various military industrial contractors, most of them located in the United States, in the Asia Pacific region over the last several years, based on this North Korean threat that we've been talked to death about over the last several years. And that has justified the THAAD missile defense, for example, in South Korea, which China and other players in the region know is not just about North Korea, but that's been the ostensible excuse for the erection of that missile defense system. And Japan, of course, has been spending a lot of money on modernizing and upgrading its military, which isn't a military, I'm honest. Don't worry, it's a self-defense force, but it's just the eighth best-funded military on the planet. And all of these players have their fingers in the pie when it comes to having some sort of boogeyman in the region that at the very least they can point to and say, that's why we need to be here. And with the elimination of that, or the potential for the elimination of that, there are players at this table who probably would want to see any sort of deal scrapped. So I think we have to understand there are countervailing forces here. It's not that everybody is going into this hoping and praying for peace.
You know, last week we had trade negotiations between, well, the United States had trade negotiations with China. Very little seems to have been achieved. There was a whole laundry list of demands from the White House that was foisted on Beijing. Of course, Trump wants China to slash the trade deficit and cyber theft of U.S. technology, which I always argued on that one, eliminate regulations, and the list goes on and on. Did Trump ask too much? Is this just something that's going to be ignored by China, or is China going to start laying down their own rules? And, you know, they own a lot of the U.S. debt. Does that come into play with any of these trade negotiations?
Well, this again creates an interesting incentive, or at least furthers along a process that I think has been underway for years, but certainly puts the extra kick in the rear end for China to... I don't think they can just ignore this right now, because America remains too important a trading partner at this point in China's economic development, but it certainly does put an onus on them to continue the diversification of their export economy, and we're already seeing signs of that. For example, the first trilateral summit between China, South Korea, and Japan in 3 years just took place. It was held in Tokyo. And one of the things to come out of that, obviously they're talking about moving towards denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, but another thing that they were talking about, oh, by the way, was closer trade agreement between China, Japan, and South Korea. So as the U.S., for example, withdraws from the TPP and starts putting these sanctions on China and Japan, by the way, Japan sort of became collateral fallout of some of these sanctions that are being slapped on China. A lot of exemptions were put in place with regards to some of these sanctions, but not for Japan, interestingly. So Japan now incentivized to start finding other markets to export to. There's a lot of incentive for China, Japan, and South Korea to form a closer trade agreement alliance. And this is, again, part of that thing that I'm talking about, so sort of shooting themselves in the foot when it comes to the Iran sanctions, for example, or when it comes to withdrawing from the TPP or slapping these sanctions on China. All of these are really incentivizing the other players around the world and some of these rising powers like China to create and to continue fostering this alternative economic and trading and financial and monetary infrastructure that's being created. And I've written about this for several years. I think that there are certain powers behind the throne in the United States that are not stupid enough not to understand this. And I think this is part of the deliberate engineering of a sort of Western downfall, or at least the downfall of the U.S. as the world predominant superpower. I think what we're seeing now is the excuse, anyway, for the creation of all of these alternative infrastructures and trading relationships. And that's only going to continue. There's no conceivable way out of this at this point, just given the way that various players like China and Japan and South Korea are being backed into an economic corner. And so the obvious thing they're going to try to do is trade more with each other. And that makes all sorts of economic sense. The only perspective from which that doesn't make sense is the geopolitical order, in which Japan, of course, is supposed to be a big rival to China, and they're under the U.S. military umbrella. Well, that can change, and it might take years, and it might be a slow process, but it looks like it already is changing, and that's ultimately to the detriment of the United States, at least from an economic and military perspective.
I can't recall there was such a time when we, and I don't know, it just kind of popped into my mind, sanctions. I mean, my heavens, there's sanctions on everyone, everything. And it's just like, on people, on governments, on trade, on money. It's sanctions. I mean, sanctions are just thrown out, and you're right. I mean, what are all of these reactions to these sanctions? I mean, countries are going to do what they have to do. They're all cutting out their piece of their pie.
Exactly. We have to keep in mind that sanctions are not a light matter. Obviously, this is just warfare by another means. It really is a type of warfare. So we can't exactly be surprised when the countries that are put under these types of sanctions start looking for alternative ways of doing business and start growing the alternatives. And I see it as the inevitable reaction to this, and one that, again, I think the long-term planners probably cannot be stupid enough not to foresee.
No. And you know, is the United States the only one that throws sanctions around to the degree? I mean, does Japan place sanctions?
They do, and sometimes they will follow the American sanctions. When America sanctions Russia, for example, Japan sometimes slaps sanctions on certain Russian officials and that sort of thing. We've seen that take place. But specifically on the Iranian deal, Japan has come out to rebuke Washington for this move and say that it's the wrong way to go and that we need the deal in place. So, again, I think America's geopolitical capital has been spent and is waning at this point.
James, I'm sorry we're out of time. Those two segments went by very quick. Thank you for joining me this afternoon, this evening, and I look forward to our talk in 2 weeks.
And thank you very much.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, make sure you visit thecorbettreport.com. Corbettreport.com. And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless. I got me a well-being man. I wouldn't have to work at all. I told